supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Family is made possible in part by the generous support of Devereaux, the nation's largest nonprofit provider of behavioral health care for children, adolescents, and adults with developmental and intellectual disabilities, behavioral disorders, and mental illness. Devereaux operates at 15 centers in 11 states throughout the country.
I'm Dan Gottlieb. Thanks for listening to Voices in the Family. I've got a friend who loves to listen to NPR. Well, I've got a lot of friends who love to listen to NPR. But this one in particular is kind of a news junkie. She likes to be up to date on all the news and is quite interested in the details. But she told me that she periodically steps away from the news and visits her CD collection, and she does it when, as she says, it just gets to her after a while. Well, her self-imposed news blackout started after 9/11. They continued through the tsunami in Asia, the recession a couple of years ago, on and on. You know, the earthquake in Haiti and of course, the Gulf spill. These large events were out of her control. They're out of all of our control. And the 24/7 news cycle was only feeding her fears and her sense of powerlessness. So to ease her stress, my friend engages in a little-known craft called good mental health. So she turns to music, exercise, or sometimes she does very weird things that I'm not going to talk about on the radio, but she finds a way to pull herself away from these stressors and recalibrate her life. But for others, external stress and reaction to the events around us almost get to our bone marrow and inform our lives, certainly inform how we experience our lives. So why can it lead to extreme distress in some while others seem to have that sought-after balance everyone talks about? Well, today I've got two guests who are going to talk about external stressors and how they affect our mental and physical health. First, I want to welcome David Posen. He's a medical doctor and author an authority on stress management. He's in Ontario, Canada, and he's the author of the little book of stress relief. David, welcome to the show.
Thanks very much, Dan.
I want to welcome Larry Palinkas. He's a professor of social work and anthropology at the University of Southern California. He was part of the team that studied the psychological effect of the Exxon Valdez oil spill in 1989. He's been spending a great deal of time at the Gulf. Larry, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for having me, Dan.
We're going to be talking about your work in more detail in just a few minutes, but I want to get some background about what stress is from David. And of course, to our listeners, we want to hear your story about the impact of these big external stressors. What kind of impact do they have on you? Do you find yourself getting more depressed, seeing the world is more half-empty or less? Give us a call, 888-477-9499. Again, that's 888-477-9499. I have a feeling we're going to get backed up with calls, so please call early in the show. So, David, before we get into external stressors and what they are, I want to understand something about this business of stress. It's certainly not all bad. I mean, I feel some stress before each show. Actually, I feel a little bit now, not knowing where the show's going to go, so on and so forth. A bit of adrenaline and anxiety, making sure everything's ready. That's a good thing.
Absolutely. And first of all, it's important to know that the stress reaction is in us. It's not out there. It's not the external circumstances. And what I really like about your topic today is you're talking about stressors, Dr. Hans Selye, one of the fathers of stress theory, made a distinction between the things that cause or generate or trigger stress and the stress reaction itself. Because a lot of people talk about stress as if it's the traffic jam that they're stuck in or the airplane that's delayed or something. That's not the stress. The stress is what's going on in your body physiologically in response to the circumstances. So it's helpful to use the word stressor or trigger rather than cause.
Right.
And the fact is that a certain amount of stress is good for us. As you point out, it makes us more attentive. It gives us more energy to do a good job. We need a certain amount of adrenaline in our system to function at our best.
Mm. You know, you talk about the external stressor in the way you did. What gets triggered for me is when I hear somebody say, "My daughter made me feel guilty." It's the same thing.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, or another one that you hear so much is, "He made me so angry." And the fact is that the anger and the guilt are our response to stuff that goes on. I mean, things happen all the time. People behave in the ways they do, and other people's behavior is one of the biggest sources of external stress for us in general. But the thing is that our response is our own, and the fact is people are going to continue to behave the way they do, but we can change how we respond to it, and that's really one of the more powerful aspects of stress mastery that I teach my patients and in my seminar.
I want to come back to the issue of constructive stress. You talked about the adrenaline. That's so helpful. So when do we cross that line from constructive to destructive, when the increased cortisol is coursing through our bodies almost without our awareness?
Well, and you point out quite rightly, because I mentioned adrenaline, and you're mentioning cortisol. Adrenaline is the hormone in acute stress. It's the alarm reaction almost. And then cortisol is the main hormone in chronic stress, and that's the one that's damaging. But the way I look at it, Dan, is that stress serves us well when it gives us energy. Well, first of all, the classic stress reaction to fight or run away from danger when we're feeling threatened. But it's also serving us well when it helps us to do a good job, when it gives us energy, because that's the main purpose of the stress reaction, to perform our tasks well. And stage performers before a performance or athletes before a big game, you want them a little keyed up because they'll do a better job that way. I make a distinction that it crosses the line when, first of all, when there's too much, when it lasts too long, or when it comes too often. And what then happens is that it starts to drain us of energy. We start to feel tired. And most people don't equate fatigue with chronic stress, but it's one of the first symptoms that happens. We start to feel tired, both mentally and physically. But the other thing is that it not only affects your energy, but it starts to feel unpleasant, and you start to get other symptoms. And I think that's where it crosses the line. The other thing is, to some extent, is it pleasant or not? You know, I'm going to a ball game tomorrow night to see the Toronto Blue Jays play the Boston Red Sox, and I hope it's going to be an exciting game, and I'm going to have fun, but I'm going to have a stress reaction at certain points of the game when it gets exciting. But I'm going to experience that in a pleasant way. It's when stress starts to feel unpleasant for people that's another signal that there's too much, and it starts to cross from good stress to bad stress, or what Hans Selye called distress.
So one of my concerns about stress and cortisol is that it gets into our system and we don't even notice it. You're talking about all these reactions, this fatigue and so on and so forth, but we don't even notice it consciously because the pace of our life is so fast. And before we know it, that the cortisol builds up, the stress reaction builds up, and all of a sudden something relatively small happens, like somebody cuts somebody off at a highway, and there can be an act of violence over something that's that small.
Yeah.
So what's happening physiologically? Does our threshold, does our baseline stress just climb up?
Well, first of all, a stress buildup with all of this cortisol, and you're right, first of all, that most people, of course, aren't aware of the hormones in their body and the buildup. So one of the things that I, and a lot of people accept too much stress as being normal because of the pace of our lives today, it's very interesting. When you start to learn how to decompress, when you learn meditation or something, and you start to really realize what relaxed feels like, then you start to realize how crazy our lives have become. But the thing is that we can pick up the signals by starting to be more self-aware and starting to scan our bodies for tension. You know, a lot of people, they get tension in their neck and their shoulders, and their shoulders start to ride up. You see them at their desk and so on. They don't even know it. And I've done this with patients in my office. I say, stop, don't move a muscle. And they stop, and then I say, look at your right hand. And it's in a fist. You know, their knuckles are white. They didn't even realize it. So starting to be more aware of the physical symptoms is very helpful. But there are also things like headaches. It can be having trouble sleeping. It can be low back pain.
What you're suggesting with your patients is what Jon Kabat-Zinn called in one of his books, coming to your senses, just kind of waking up and just noticing how you feel right now at this moment. I wrote in my recent book, Wisdom of Sam, I've got a grandson on the autism spectrum, and one day he had a meltdown, and, you know, he just collapsed after, you know, and sobbed. And when he reconstituted himself, he was in his mother's arms, and he had to be 6, 7 years old. And he said, Mommy, everything just went too fast inside my head today. And that was so telling, because any of us could say that, but we don't notice. And he did. And noticing changes everything.
Absolutely. Awareness is hugely important, and so many people are living on automatic pilot. They're so programmed to be looking down the road, and they've got so many things they're worrying about that they don't even pay attention to their own bodies. It's hugely important.
Let me ask you one more question before we go to the calls. This business of external stress, like you pointed out, can be a bit confusing, because after all, isn't it just a matter of perception? I've treated many people with serious illnesses, and their reaction to the illness is really across the spectrum. Same illness, different reaction. So is there an objective way to understand what external stressors are?
Yes, and I think that's the really key piece, is that events and situations rarely cause stress. They trigger stress, but they rarely cause stress. I mean, unless you're mugged on the street or something like that. So what happens is that things occur, whether it's an event like a flood in your basement or somebody's behavior, cutting off at the, you know, on the highway, or a plane delayed at the airport. What happens is that we process that event intellectually, and we do it in an instant. When your phone rings at 2:30 in the morning, you know, even if you're awake at the time, going to the bathroom or something, when the phone rings, most people will have a very sudden stress reaction, sure, an alarm reaction. Because most people think that when the phone rings in the middle of the night, it's a crisis, somebody died, an emergency, something like that. But when you really tease it apart, even though the stress reaction happens very, very quickly, like in a millisecond almost, you start to realize that it's based on interpretations we make or judgments we make. We give meaning to things that happen. And it's the meaning or the interpretations that usually will create the stress reaction. And so if people can start to realize that what's happening out there, the events in the world, all these external things, are maybe triggering a stress reaction, but we are actually, in a sense, part of the process, too. We have a little filter in our head.
Yeah, so it's never about the thing. It's what the thing means to us.
Exactly.
It reminds me, last year I read Bruce Lipton's The Biology of Beliefs, and you know, he demonstrates how our beliefs change our physiology. So our perception then becomes real and inside our brains.
Absolutely. I mean, if somebody, if you don't think very well of yourself and then somebody ignores you at a social function, you may start this little tape in your head that says, you know, nobody's interested in me, I'm not interesting, I'm not good enough, and all the rest of it. And the person may, in fact, have been on their way to the bathroom or something and didn't notice you, but you interpret it, and then if you have a pattern of certain kinds of thinking, then it just keeps reinforcing that kind of thinking. And that's why getting into belief systems and starting to make people realize that there is such a thing as beliefs, these premises and assumptions we hold, and then to start noticing them, we start to see how we set ourselves up a lot of the time for these stress reactions.
Mm. Well, as promised, let's see if we can get a phone call in before we have to go to our break and then talk with Larry about major stressors that happen around the world. We've got Leland on the line.
Hello.
Hi there.
Hello, how are you?
I'm okay. How are you?
I'm very well. Thank you very much.
We've got a couple of minutes before our break, so tell us what your thoughts are about stress.
Well, the reason I called was my reaction to the stress of negative media. It was literally after the Virginia Tech shooting.
Yeah.
I decided to donate a kidney altruistically to a total stranger as a way to counteract the negativism, to create good in the face of evil.
Well,
and in December of 08, I donated a kidney.
And how are you now? Physically?
I'm great. I just got back from the National Kidney Foundation's transplant games in Madison, Wisconsin. Had a great experience there, seeing the fruits of that labor of all the people who live full lives because of the transplant process. But also got to meet some other altruistic donors, people who decided to do something positive.
Wow.
Really out of thin air.
Well, I have to tell you that when you told me you donated a kidney, you are one of the few people that left me without words. I had nothing to say. That was such a moving and powerful thing that you've done. Thanks for calling the show and sharing your story. David, altruism really does help one's attitude. You know, I was thinking of, and we'll talk to Larry in just a minute about this, the BP oil spill. So you can look at that and say, well, those SOPs, those, you know, money mongering people don't care about anything but their own profits. Or, you know, you can approach this with, as my Buddhist friend would say, an open heart, a compassionate, loving heart, and think, well, what can I do to help these people down there? What can I do to help the world that just got injured? Same oil spill, two different reactions.
Absolutely. And here's what's interesting, too, about these events that are distant from us. A lot of people can't do anything about the event itself, obviously, but they can mobilize themselves to do something. It might be, after the tsunami, for example, or Hurricane Katrina, to donate money. It might be donating time to become a fundraiser for some of these things. It might be becoming involved in some advocacy group to try and keep these things from happening again. It can be active involvement. For example, after the earthquake in Haiti, a lot of people actually flew to Haiti to become actively involved on
the
ground.
Like I said at a recent speech, I read a poem, and one of the lines in the poem was, we can't wipe out hunger, but we can feed a hungry person.
Uh-huh.
So,
and doing something active can certainly be a very constructive way of dealing with one's own stress, because as you pointed out in your introduction, the feeling of powerlessness, of helplessness, of a loss of control is one of the big reasons why so many of these things feel so threatening and so stressful. And so being able to do something, even if it's small, is an active way of taking some control in some way. One of my mottos is control the things that you can control. And there are a number of ways that you can respond to things. Now, your caller made one of the most exceptional. I was also speechless, by the way. An amazing.
And part of knowing what we can control is what we talked about earlier, is coming to our senses, just stopping and taking a breath and looking inside. Well, we've just been talking with Dr. David Posen. He's a medical doctor, and he's written the little book of stress relief. We will talk with him after our break, but we will also talk with Larry Palinkas. He's a professor of social work and anthropology at the University of Southern California, and he was part of the team that studied the psychological effects of the Exxon Valdez oil spill in 1989. We're talking about stress, external stressors, how we cope with them, what impact they have on us, and what kind of power we really have over ourselves and over our environment. Our phone number is 888-477-9499. Again, that's 888-477-9499, and I look forward to talking with you. Well, I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family. It's right here on WHYY-FM.
Fox Chase Cancer Center supports WHYY. Fox Chase Cancer Center Buckingham is fitted out with the latest radiation technology, including a CyberKnife robotic radio surgery system. Located near Doylestown, Fox Chase Cancer Center Buckingham offers patients convenient access to all the resources of an NCI-designated comprehensive cancer center. Fox Chase Cancer Center Buckingham is in the Heritage Center on Route 263. More at foxchase.org. Fox Chase, perfecting the science of compassionate cancer care.
On the next Fresh Air, Jonathan Eich takes us back to the Roaring Twenties in Chicago, when cops and judges were on the take, bootleggers were mowing each other down, and Al Capone bragged to reporters about his underworld clout. He made his reputation the day he approached a rival in broad daylight.
Says hello, puts the gun to his cheek, fires six times, and holds him on the barstool as he keeps firing.
What you didn't know about Al Capone. Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
We are back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. We are talking about something everyone listening to this show can relate to. That's stressors. What external stressors do to our lives and what we can do to our lives in the face of external stressors. We've been talking with Dr. David Posen, a physician and authority on stress management. We've been chatting with him in his home in Ontario, Canada. But we're going to be speaking now with Larry Palinkas. He's a professor of social work and anthropology at the University of Southern California. He was part of the team that studied the psychological effects of the Exxon Valdez oil spill. Thanks so much for joining us, Larry.
It's a pleasure to be here.
So, Larry, you've been listening to David and I talk about it's all a matter of perception, and it's not about the thing, but it's about what the thing means to you, and does that really hold up in Alaska with the Exxon Valdez or the Gulf, when all of a sudden your world is turned upside down, or the earthquake in Haiti? Are we being Pollyannish here?
Oh, it certainly does hold up. In fact, many of the people who have studied or devoted their lives studying stress have talked about the fact that the way you interpret or appraise an event as, you know, being stressful or as representing a loss of control will make the difference between those people who experience the symptoms of stress, both physical and psychological, and those people who seem to be resilient to that, who seem to cope very well. And certainly that was the case in Alaska, where the stress was not the oil itself or fear of physical health effects from being directly exposed to the oil, although that was a factor, but it was more the death of a way of life and the way that the people and their cultures interpreted that event as destroying a way of life that was based on the commercial fishing that was done in the area, but even more importantly, the subsistence activities, hunting, fishing, and gathering as a way of validating and confirming one's culture, especially if you are an Alaskan native.
I'm curious about just that. David and I have been talking about individual stress and individual stressors, but what you study is communities and its impact on communities, and I wonder if there's something about being part of a larger group that helps mitigate the effects.
Well, generally, being part of a larger group is absolutely essential to coping with stress and dealing with traumatic events. And you have to think of many of these events as being primarily social in nature. So, yes, property is damaged, lives are lost, but the most valuable resource that people have is other people. And when the event begins to destroy that resource, that's when you begin to see a number of psychological problems. In the case of Alaska, perhaps the greatest impact of the oil spill was the disruption in social relations. The fact that people were reporting increased conflicts with their spouse, their children, other relatives, or their neighbors and friends. And oil spills are a little different from other kinds of natural disasters, like the earthquake in Haiti, in the sense that rather than bringing people together in a common cause, many times they split them apart and deprive each individual that access to that valuable resource.
What's the difference?
Well, the difference oftentimes has to be in the response to the event itself. So that, for example, in cleanup activities, many times, whether it's British Petroleum or back then Exxon, in their attempt to hire local people to help participate in cleanup activities, not everyone was given a job, or some people were given very profitable jobs and other people were not given those opportunities. And that created conflicts within individuals and within communities. Later on, when the issue of litigation came up, some communities or some groups participated in class action suits and others did not. That also created tension within communities.
What makes things, so you've described what makes things worse on a community level. What makes things better? For example, you know, I talked about my friend at the beginning of the show who turned away from the news when it gets stressful, and that's what most mental health professionals recommended in this country after 9/11. So what does help mitigate stress when a community has faced a disaster?
Well, just as there are resilient individuals who, by virtue of their personality or access to resources, are able to cope with what seem to be the most traumatic types of events, I think there are also resilient communities. And one of the characteristics of those types of communities happens to be the leadership. Many times, whether it's a mayor or city council, individuals who are able to mobilize resources, but mobilize individuals to work for one another, tend to be able to cope with these kinds of events much better than individuals who are scrambling for resources or you know, assigning blame to others for the failure to respond in a satisfactory fashion. But communities that essentially work together largely because they have the leadership that can mobilize those resources, and perhaps also the training, the ability to, for example, identify which members of the community or which households are having a more difficult time coping with an event like this than others, and the ability to reach out and to identify resources for these individuals.
So it's like anything else. The more compassionate you are, the more outside of your own head you are, the happier you'll be, the better you'll cope with your life.
Well, yes, there is a give and take between the ability to, you know, work for and focus on the needs of your neighbors, as well as the work for and focus on your own needs.
Sure.
And I think you have to realize that they go hand in hand, that one cannot be completely altruistic without meeting your own individual needs, but one cannot be completely self-serving without meeting the needs of the community.
Let's bring some of our callers in who want to join this conversation. Dave, you still there?
I am.
Okay, so let's bring Barry on.
Barry? Hi, thanks for taking my call. I draw a clear distinction between stress that requires the individual to adapt to unwanted change and major traumatic experiences that overwhelm, and that the approach to stress is to cope and to get supports, but the response to trauma is actually a healing one. And do your speakers think that this distinction is a useful one to take?
Well, I'm curious. Let's turn to you, Larry.
Well, yes, you have to look at individual and social stress or community stress as two distinct phenomena. What links them together, however, is that there is a social component to both. So, for example, when you are experiencing the stress that comes from unemployment or a death in the family, many times you can mobilize your social support network to help you cope with that event. In a event or traumatic event that affects an entire community, when that support system itself becomes disrupted, it's much more difficult to do that. So in that sense, they really are two different phenomenon. What makes both of those stressful, however, is that individuals begin to feel isolated, cut off from their social environments. And it's the ability to provide those resources, whether it's affecting an individual or affecting an entire community, that coping with stress becomes exceedingly critical.
Barry, thanks so much for your call. Larry, I would like to get more personal, more clinical here. You've spent a lot of times in New Orleans this spring and summer. What are you seeing, hearing, feeling over there?
Well, unfortunately, I've been hearing a lot of the same stories, of same statements that we heard in Alaska 20 years ago. We hear parents expressing fear about the health of their children. We are hearing people who've lost their jobs in the fishing industry hoping for an assignment in the Vessels of Opportunity program that BP has instituted as a way of keeping fishermen employed by having them participate in cleanup activities, and saying that if they don't get a job within the next week, they're going to kill themselves.
And the suicide rate, is that high down there?
Well, there have been no statistics demonstrating an increase, although anecdotally we've been hearing more reports of suicidal ideation and calls into suicide hotlines.
Have we learned anything? I mean, from our experience in Alaska with the Exxon Valdez, have we learned anything there that we can apply that could be helpful for the people in the Gulf and in terms of their psychological well-being?
Well, I think bringing mental health services to bear right at the outset is absolutely critical. I know that the states affected by the oil spill have been attempting to get compensation from British Petroleum to provide additional revenues to, you know, hire additional psychologists, social workers, psychiatrists who provide services in the area. The sooner we can get those services in place, I think the better the communities are in the long run. One of the things that we have learned, and I think to the credit of British Petroleum, was by making available a fund of money to compensate victims of the oil spill at the outset, rather than to wait after decades of litigation, as was the case with Exxon,
right,
has helped to at least provide some measure of certainty as to what the outcomes are likely to be. Nevertheless, perhaps the most devastating stress associated with both of these events is uncertainty. So even if people can return to fishing, in the next few days or next few weeks, concerns about the safety of seafood may prevent people from purchasing that food, which could have economic impact.
So we can look at the oil, we can look at BP's behavior, the government's behavior, and there is still so much unknown about the future. Larry, I want to thank you so much for joining us, and especially thanks for the work you do. It's so terribly important in today's world.
My pleasure.
That was Dr. Larry Palenkas. He's a professor of social work and anthropology at the University of Southern California. He's part of the team that studied the effects of the Exxon Valdez and now Gulf oil spills. When we come back, we're going to talk a bit about what we can do about this and how we can really manage those external stressors and turn them into facts rather than tell ourselves stories about that, so the stress turns into cortisol and controls our life. We'll be doing that with Dr. David Posen. He's a medical doctor, authority on stress management, and the author of The Little Book of Stress Relief. We'll be back in just 1 minute. I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family. It's right here on WHYY FM.
The Pennsylvania Academy of the Fine Arts supports WHYY. Continuing education at PAFA has art classes and workshops for all ages and levels this fall in drawing, painting, sculpture, printmaking, and more. Featuring Saturday classes for high school students, art appreciation in the PAFA Museum and Vaults, a masterclass with Stuart Shills, and an art tour of Istanbul, Turkey. For details, 215-972-7632 or pafa.org/CE.
He is a Grammy Award-winning singer, a successful producer, and an outspoken social activist, but now he says he wants to be the president of Haiti. We talk to Wyclef Jean next time on Tell Me More.
If I was president, if I was
this afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
We are back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. We're talking about external stressors and how we turn them into internal stressors. We're talking with Dr. David Posen, who is an expert on stress. He's written a little book of stress relief. Our number is 888-477-9499. David, you said that the number one source of stress is that voice inside of our heads.
Yes, it is, and it's relentless for some people, but it's there all the time, and it's commenting on things. And we first of all need to learn to tune into it more, and then to realize that amazingly and powerfully, we can actually start to change the way we think about things, and by doing that, we can change the way we feel about those things.
Yeah, I noticed that voice inside our heads rarely comes out. You know, like when we're looking in the mirror and says, "Hey, you look great today, Dan." You know, that voice just doesn't have a lot of positive vibe to it. It's usually criticism and demand.
Well, and more for some people than others. Some people have a more sunny outlook, and they're able to reframe things and to see the upside of situations. And but what's really important is that you can learn to train yourself to think differently by asking yourself certain questions, like, how else can I think about this? Is there any upside to this? Are there any positives? Are there any benefits? Is there anything I can learn from this? And by asking yourself those questions, I learned about reframing actually for the first time about 28 years ago. And I have learned now over the years to just do it automatically. And I've watched and helped my patients do the same thing. So you can actually change that little voice and get it to be more helpful and more positive, and not in a Pollyanna way, as you point out, because not everything's quite wonderful. But to be able to put things in context, one of the most powerful things I heard after 9/11 was an interview with a journalist in New York City who talked about how people were distancing themselves from what happened. And the way he put it was this. He said, people started to say to themselves, this didn't just happen in the United States. It happened in New York City. It happened in Washington and the Pentagon. And, of course, it happened in your territory and in Pennsylvania.
Right.
But then people in New York say, well, it didn't really happen in New York City. It happened in Manhattan. And then people said, well, it didn't actually happen in Manhattan. It happened downtown. And then other people said, well, it didn't just happen downtown. It happened around Wall Street. And what they were trying to do was to come to grips with and put in perspective this unbelievably catastrophic event, and to start to come to grips with it. And I thought that was a very powerful example of how people started to mobilize the way they think about the event, and to put it in some way so that if they were living in Seattle, they weren't feeling immediately threatened.
I want to get a perspective here on stress before we go back to the phones. We've defined it. We've talked about external stressors. You've talked about the voice inside our head and cortisol. And all of that's true. But our level of stress, now you're Canadian, so I don't know if this holds up for you guys, but our level of stress, certainly in this country, has increased exponentially over the last three decades. It didn't begin with 9/11. It's increased exponentially in the last three decades. So why is that? Why are we seeing the world as more threatening and more frightening today than perhaps we ever did before? And I'm including, you know, World War II. This country's probably under more stress than it's ever been before.
Well, and it's very interesting to think that, you know, America went through the Depression and then World War II, and stress levels were, as you say, very high. But I think what's happening now are probably a number of things. One of them is we have more information. I'm actually reading a very good book right now called Spark by Dr. John Rady at Harvard University. And he said something really interesting in this book, and I've lost my reference here. He said, in the context of stress, the great paradox of the modern age may be that there is not more hardship, just more news, and too much of it.
Mm.
The 24/7 streaming torrent of tragedy and demands, et cetera, et cetera. What's happening, I think, is that not only is there more information, and this 24 news cycle, I think, is one of the most dangerous, insidious influences in our lives, And I think part of the problem is that people are immersing themselves in all of this information and all of this bad news, and just upsetting themselves endlessly. So I think that's one of the things. But the fact is, the world is changing more quickly now with technology, and there's so many things for people to adjust to, technology, the economy, and so on. So there's a lot going on externally as well, and I think the rate of change has been staggering. And then add to that the fact that we can learn all of these terrible things that are happening almost minute by minute and in great detail. I think those are two of the biggest factors right there.
Yeah, and sadly, we're not going to get that genie back in the bottle. Let's go to the phones. We've got Beth on the line. Beth?
Hi. I have a question. How do you deal with extreme chronic stress when you know it's going to last a long time? And you literally have tried everything, and it's not going to change.
Give us an example besides babies crying.
Yeah. I divorced my abusive ex-husband 3 years ago. I left him 4 years, and it was 3 years ago. Now, I live overseas. I'm actually visiting my family here now. But because of the Hague Convention on Child Abduction, if I leave without his permission and he threatens me through the children, through the court system, everything, I will be branded as a child abductor. My children really come home with stories about my death and my funeral, and they have for the last 4 years on the visitations with him. And because they don't do anything over there or are extremely reluctant, I'm literally stuck. I was employed for a while, lost my job because of the employment, because I am a foreigner over there, even though I speak the language fluently. My job prospects are... So I have nothing, and because it was, you know, a divorce, and he was an abuser, I really lost my whole social network there, too. You try everything you can and kind of fall on your face again, and I just hope I'll make it these next 9 years that I have to wait until my children are of age that we can leave and I can move back to my family here.
Okay, so hang on. And, David, you know, we've talked about internal stressors and perceptions, but this is a woman whose external stresses are gargantuan. And, you know, unlike what we heard with Larry, there's no community. There's a sense of isolation here. So what does one do to live the life they have?
Well, first of all, realistic expectations are hugely important, and to know what the reality is and will be for this next number of years is one piece. Another, I think, might be to write down all of the things that you can control. You say that you've lost a lot of your social network, but it doesn't prohibit you from developing a new social network.
Yes, but many of the people I have met are foreign women in the same situation I am, so it kind of, you never kind of get away from it.
Well, I mean, there are some, first of all, when I talk about finding a social network, it may be in a variety of ways. It may be finding common cause with the people who are in the same situation as you are, but it also may involve things that are very specific to you in terms of physiology. So, and I don't want to sound trite by any means, but there are times when you simply can't do anything about the situation. But things like regular exercise is hugely important because it actually affects brain chemistry.
Yeah,
it actually affects, it lowers stress levels and anxiety. It actually improves mood for people who are depressed. And it does it in specific ways that happen in the brain.
David, we're running low
yes.
on time, and,
yep.
and we're going to have to say goodbye to Beth. Beth, thank you so much, and we do wish you the best. The issue really is, as David is saying, the issue is caring for your brain. There's not much you can do about your external life, and sadly, this is the life you have. But we do need to care for your brain, we need to care for your heart too, if I may. We need to care for you. And you know what David's suggesting is begin with exercise and
meditation. And, by the way, Dan, would be another area to explore.
Yeah, of course, meditation, yoga, tai chi, good healthy diet, but act in kindness towards yourself and not facing just the external environment, which nobody is minimizing, is just awful, but act with kindness for yourself. David, we are just about out of time, and I really want to thank you for your time and for the work you do, for what you contribute. Any final thoughts for us?
Well, first of all, thank you for having me on your show, Dan. I'm very impressed by your program in general, what I've learned about it, and certainly the content of this one. I think probably the line that I... line is the wrong word. My motto for myself and for my patients is control the things that you can control. And the good news is you have more control than you think, because we control the way we behave, we control the way we think, and we control the lifestyle choices.
That's certainly an upbeat note on which to end. Thanks so much for joining us, David.
My pleasure. Thank you.
David Posen's a physician, and he's written a little book on stress relief. Earlier we heard from Larry Palinkas, a professor of social work and anthropology at UCLA. Next week, we'll talk about staying on top of your game despite pressures to perform, and we're going to be talking about deeper issues of social anxiety. One of our guests is going to be a social psychologist. Another one will be a psychologist who works with CEOs. So if you've got a question, comment, or idea, call us or email us. We're at voices@whyy.org. You can also reach me at drdangottlieb.com. Well, the engineer for today's show has been Al Banks. Thank you, Al. Elizabeth Perez Luna is our executive producer of audio content. Mike and Scott is our executive producer. Jennifer Lynn is our producer. Evan Pliss is our intern par excellence. We had a special guest of Judy Kuo joined us this week from Taiwan. Thank you, Judy. Me, I'm Dan Gottlieb. Have a great week, my friends. You're one.